Welcome to the Undisciplined Podcast. I'm Nico Buitendag. Today I have the very special honor of speaking to my friend Andreas Philippopoulos Mialopoulos. Apart from being a professor in law at University of Westminster, Andreas is also an artist, fiction writer, and many other things. We talk about systems theory, environmental law, and intriguingly, water. Andreas, thank you very much for being here and finally speaking to me today. We've known each other for a while. I actually realized this year, and give or take a few months, is exactly 10 years since the first and only time I met you in person in Tilburg. But we've been in communication since, and you've always been very kind to me. You even wrote a little blurb on my book that came out a while ago. So thank you very much for doing this, and very welcome to the podcast.
Everything's a pleasure. I mean, the meeting and the blurb for the book was a pleasure. And so congratulations to the book. It's a really, really important book, I think. So it wasn't just an amiable gesture. It was meant, in all honesty, that's a very important book.
Well, thank you. Very kind. But we have a sort of a tradition here of asking people to give a short introduction or biography of themselves. But I think in your case, and this is something that will become clear in my subsequent questions maybe, but I want to know your academic poiesis and autopoiesis, but especially in relation to how you got to law. That's something that I'm wondering about quite a bit. So do you mind sharing a little bit about that?
Thank you. I guess I'm wondering a little bit about this too, and I have been wondering about it until I think it was even after I completed a few years of psychoanalysis, I realized why I studied law. But I shan't spill the beans immediately. As many things, it was an accident. It was a bourgeois accident. It was a kind of a question of, okay, what would the son of two, you know, medical doctors will become if their son doesn't want to become a medical doctor? And that I knew what I didn't want to do. I was very aware of the negative, but I wasn't so aware of the positive as mostly it happens with me. So law came up seemingly randomly. The idea was, I think the ultimate idea was to work in the diplomatic corps, or just generally, so maybe the political sphere or something like that. But subsequently, I realized quite quickly, actually, that it would require a huge amount of political and personal compromises. And then I decided not to follow that. And somehow, again, out of inertia, just carried on studying. So I went for a master's degree and then a PhD. And because, again, I couldn't easily think of what I wanted to do, I just carried on in the field of law. Now, it's not that I'm not interested in the law, I don't like the law, but I've always had a very complex connection to the law. And I've noticed that after speaking to quite a few of my colleagues whom I thought were of the same mind, in the sense that they wouldn't accept the law necessarily as something to be, you know, dealt with very, very seriously. I'm thinking about some critical legal theorist, for example. And then I realized that they actually are a little bit besotted with the law, and I've never been. And therefore, the law became a bit of a tool, became actually a line, a moment of transgression or a moment of containment, a moment of peeking out or staying in. And this paradox has always been with me. And of course, the autopoetic nature of this stance, I think, was becoming clearer to me even before I obviously came across the terminology in Luhmann and Toibner, etc. But I have a more maybe prosaic answer to this. And this is something that I've realized that quite often I deal with things I'm afraid of. It's not so much about, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I don't go for the thing that scares me. No. But possibly yes. And so I realized that I was a little bit afraid of the law. I've always been a little bit afraid of the law because of its contingency, because of the fact that it's a loose cannon. It can go anyway, and it doesn't matter whether you're innocent or guilty, or, you know, everyone is guilty, or everyone has guilt of some sort. You know, we all kind of, certainly the ones who were brought up in the Judeo-Christian tradition, can't go away from that. So it didn't take much to realize that the guilt in me would come out as fear towards the law and what the law could possibly do with me. And then, of course, the psychoanalytical aspect came, and it became very clear to me that I had to deal with some father issues. And these father issues were, of course, a question of law. And it was since then that I realized that I realized that the law for me isn't important externally, but internally. That is the law that we embody, the law that is within the body, not just the human body, but generally the body, when I say the collective body, whether it's society or a particular assemblage, or and the way that this law moves this body or makes it stop, and how the law is embodied by this body, and therefore takes up, that is, the law takes up the movement of the body in which it's being embodied. So immediately I started being interested in this, again, this sort of paradox of containment. So neither of these two things contain each other, yet they both seem to be working on the level of embodiment and movement in very tight ways.
That's really interesting. And you're talking about this very physical aspect of the law, but also the psychoanalytic aspect, because your latest full book that came out was actually a book of prose, of short stories, entitled The Book of Water. And I thought about it, that you dedicate this whole volume to something like water. And I thought already, wow, I think this was before I read the book. I thought for you and I, we're probably approaching this topic from very different ways, because I thought, I'm presuming that you grew up in Greece.
Correct.
And I think you now live in Venice.
Well, London and Venice.
London and Venice. But, you know, if I think of Greece and Venice, these are places that, you know, even if we take it as a postcard summary of each of them, they are going to have water in that photo, right? Where I grew up, of course, South Africa is a coastal country, but I grew up in Johannesburg and Pretoria. I think, I don't know if this is true for a fact, but I at least heard somewhere once that Johannesburg is the biggest city in the world that's not built next to a body of water, next to the ocean or a lake or a river. You've been here. It's dry. The ocean is 600 kilometers, 700 kilometers away. I grew up, the only water I knew was water coming from a tap. And water, big bodies of water, since childhood, fill me with a bit of anxiety. And I thought, when I approached the book, I thought, wow, I think what Andreas feels about water and what I feel about water would be quite different. But then when I read it, you kind of expressed a lot of the anxiety that I felt about water. And not in all the stories. Sometimes it's there, sometimes not. And of course, coming from it from the angle that I am, secondly, from the legal side, of course, I look at the water probably more than you intend, as a metaphor for law too. And you bring in this anxiety of the law, and there's something really palpable and visceral about the characters and their relationship to water. How am I reading too much into it, the legal thing and the psychoanalytic thing, or what were you trying to express in the Book of Water?
No, I think you're not reading at all too much. I think you're absolutely right in the sense that I was sort of prefacing the water by saying that I actually deal with the things I often am afraid of. And water is one of those things. And despite the fact that, yes, as you said, I grew up in coastal. In fact, you know, the apartment in which I was mainly brought up was by the water in the center of the Thessaloniki. And so water was always a horizon, if anything else. And of course, the summers, you know, blah, 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 there's always this. But and somehow this readily availability of water, at least visual water, in where was I was born and brought up, kind of translated into the book, because I was afraid and I still am afraid of water, at the same time being fascinated by it. And I think that certainly works on a parallel level with the law. There's a sense of the elemental which overwhelms me, and yet it, so I'm, you know, so I feel very small in relation to it. At the same time, it makes me feel in a continuum with it, and at my more, let's say, well, calmer moments about the future, I find myself drifting a little bit. There's a Requiem composed by a French impressionist composer, Gabriel Fauré. And it's probably the most peaceful Requiem that exists, well, of the ones I know. It follows the usual structure of a Requiem with the same, you know, the same lyrics as every other Requiem. But it eschews any big explosion. Everything is almost pointing into this final fading out. There's a calmness and a placidity in both in the composition as well as in the way that I think it should be sung. Not everyone sings it like this, unfortunately. But then again, that's probably only my interpretation. And in a way, water does that. So it has an immensity in my mind. And of course, it can be also contained as I'll get to that in a minute. But as an element, it has an immensity and also a softness. And so these two things somehow correspond to a way of seeing the law as something that is pretty much everywhere. In my work on the lawscape, I've been thinking precisely of the law as the stuff that jumps up everywhere and is embodied by everything, and embodies precisely all the movements and the other bodies around it and in it. And yet it can, maybe for this reason, it can be used. So it doesn't always have the violence that, say, some critical legal theorists or even some, I suppose, critical sociolegal theorists are dealing with. And that probably is a very Lumanian aspect. So I've never been particularly interested in the violence of the law, although I could see that the law can be violent. But at the same time, I could see the law as being something that you can, almost like a plasticine, you can actually move it along your body and make it correspond to what you need. But of course, it can overwhelm you, precisely like water. So that's one part of the answer. The other part perhaps refers to the kind of water I'm working on in the Book of Water. And this came from my Greek publisher, because this book was initially published in Greek. And this is a translation into English. So although the book was written on a small island where I go regularly, well, I used to go regularly pretty much every year on holidays and stay for quite a few days, almost 3 weeks at the time. And this island is tiny, like 40 permanent residents and just a single taverna. And the place where we used to stay would be right on the beach. The beach was enormous, like 4 kilometers, and no one there. And so there was this constant visual contact with the water. And quite a lot of these stories emerged from either images, fixed images that I would see in front of me, or stories from people either visiting the island or staying on the island. And yet, although I had this immensity in front of me, I realized that in order to deal with the kind of water I wanted, I needed to chop it up, put it into little boxes, contain it. So when my publisher, my Greek publisher, said, your water is not the big, romantic, vast, open expanses of water, but it is one of a modernist. It's one where everything is contained in small pools and boxes. And I realized she was absolutely right. It hadn't occurred to me. So this kind of water is the one that can guarantee, let's say, the what I need in terms of the placid aspect of it. I want my water to be soft and flat and lightly lapping. And of course, this is a huge element of control. I needed maybe to control this water, to stop it from overwhelming me. But in quite a few stories, you might have noticed the ultimate, well, I say goal, but the ultimate moment, the pinnacle of the story is the dissolution of the self into the water. So there is a moment where you become water, and or the, you know, the various protagonists of the short stories. That's a Gabriel Fauré moment. It's when you become one with this final placid water moment. You know, of course, this is death in many respects, but it's also a planetary death. It's a moment where everything becomes covered up by this blanket, this one surface that, of course, is circular, but it's spherical, but it remains a surface. It's an unbroken surface. And, you know, harks back to biblical floods, but also in what is happening currently. So there's a lot of paradoxes, again, vying with each other in a sense, you know, this both the openness and the, you know, the open expanse or the closure of the containment of the water, the softness, but also the overwhelm, the feeling overwhelmed by the water, and the need to be in the water, but also not to be in the water, the need to become water, but also to maintain a distance from the water in order to be able to see it to keep it as a visual horizon.
What's interesting for me, on a few different levels on things that you've said now, is to connect the water with your academic writing, where I think, like no one else, your academic writing, for lack of a better word, the thickness of the lore in your work, you write quite evocatively in even your academic work about lore being kind of seeped in and soaked through absolutely everything. And you talk about this becoming one with water, but you also, your writing sort of talks about our bodies going into lore and lore going into our bodies. I think you're the master of palpable lore, or writing about lore very palpably. And then on the other hand, I would claim that you're probably the most important legal writer on Luhmann, which for me has always been this very ever-present, this very thin kind of ethereal way of looking at the world. Do you see a conflict there? And is that something that kind of drew you to autopoietic systems theory or critical autopoiesis? Or are you fighting against that?
That's nice.
Is it an attraction or a repulsion that makes you deal with this theory?
Okay, so there's quite a few things in this question, so perhaps I need to unpack it a little bit. First of all, thank you for saying what you said about the writing, because I think it's a nice way of putting it, cloying, dense, I don't know, treacle. Sometimes I feel that it's not impenetrable, but it opens up its own little labyrinth, and I'm powerless before it. I mean, the text writes itself quite often, and I don't claim to be able to control it. And I enjoy this process. And I think this is the moment when the text is being written, when it is actually being written, not by me, but when somehow it writes itself. And that is the moment when the text takes off. I welcome these moments, despite the fact that quite often, and I guess this is something that has allowed me to enjoy it. It was my art practice that has allowed me to enjoy this process without guilt. That to see the text being written means that you are often detached from its intense structural rationality. So you see the text unfolding. You follow the folds, and sometimes it leads you to things that you're not even entirely sure what this is about. And I'm actually referring to the academic text now, not even the not even the poetic or the the fiction. So one thing I've been working on now. So something you might not be aware of is that I've recently published a novel. The novel is called Our Distance Became Water. And surprise, surprise, is about water again. Book has been published as a catalogue for a visual and visual arts and installation exhibition I've had recently in London at Daniel Arnault Gallery. It was a collaborative show with sound artist and installation artist Robert Cervera. He's a London-based artist, and we worked together on the text itself, on the text of the novel. So the novel was completed before the exhibition, and Robert and I worked on some readings of the text where he composed music on the basis of these readings, for these readings. And these readings, these pieces, because it's music and text recitation, form the basis, let's say, of the exhibition. So there are about six of these pieces. And they describe various instances. Well, they are various instances of the book, and perhaps in some ways some important, very important instances of the book, and always having to do with water. The exhibition had several other elements as well. There was a big installation and also paintings, and it also had an olfactory element because I worked with perfumier Marina Basilina, who works with perfumes, and she devised, we kind of worked together to devise a scent that imbued the paintings. And anyway, so it created a whole atmosphere of a visual and oral and olfactory, atmospheric immersion. And this was one part of the exhibition. Now, this book still has the same kind of water. It's a water, but I think I'm dealing with my fear a bit more head on there. And it's a water that floods a city. And this water, though, arrives at the second floor of the major buildings. It doesn't go further than that. Of course, the residents don't know it. And it kind of shows how, how the everyday goes. But it's also seen through the story of two lovers. The lovers are, the gender of the lovers, let's say, is not obvious. So the reader is invited to construct their own gender impression. But that's not very important indeed, because the main thing is that they had already invited water in their relationship before the flood. This means that the water forms part of the relationship both in a metaphorical, physical, and metaphysical way. So there are quite a few stories where the lovers connect or disconnect through water. Water is just a normal happenstance in their flat, and even, as I say, before the flood. Now, this kind of water is one that spreads, that is threatening, but the threat always comes from within. It doesn't have big waves, for example. It doesn't have moments of surprising engulfment. It's always there, and I think the risk is as deep as the depth of the water. So working on this book, I realized that I was coming closer and closer to another interest of mine, which was the city and the way that the law works in the city. So quite a lot of the book, which, by the way, is going to be published as a regular novel, you know, to be found in the shops and Amazon and all the stuff by Eris at the end of this year, beginning of next year, is I realized that it was almost replacing the law, or indeed it was introducing a new or perhaps a very old law of how the bodies would move. And so that was no metaphor. That was the water that became the new, let's say, or the old new law. And from that, I realized that I was really interested in working a little bit more academically with water. So now I'm working on an academic book for Polity Press called, the book is called Hydro Justice. And it is precisely about this connection between law and water. I'm really interested in moving away from metaphors and thinking of water in its pure ontology as law, and the way that the water comes in and impacts on our conceptualization of what justice is. So hydro justice would be a justice that is elemental through and through. That is, that we cannot think of justice even in the sense that I use in spatial justice, that is in terms of the emplacement of bodies in space and time. Even in that sense, we cannot think of it independently of water. So water becomes perhaps the main element that determines, or that must from now on determine, our understanding of what justice is. So in a sense, the argument of the book is that justice is by necessity hydro justice, and if it's not, then it's not justice at all. So this is the current, you know, this is where I am at in terms of academic, and finally I managed to put together my fiction and artistic practices together with my academic writing. I mean, I don't know how successful this is going to be, because it's not an easy endeavor, but I'm trying. And then Luhmann in all this, because of course I think I became quite infatuated with the theory when autopoiesis was introduced in the theory. So I read it and I think I understood it before autopoiesis. But when I really felt it was when the text started changing and addressing or addressing autopoietic processes and using autopoiesis as a main terminological reference. And what I found about this is the freedom it gave me to focus on the no, that is, on the environment of the system rather than the system itself. So as I'm sure that your listeners will be aware of, that Luhmann's theory focuses on systems, social systems, how society is made up of various social systems, and which are, you know, law, religion, politics, etc. And what happens in between? Well, nothing happens between, because everything is system anyway. And except that the system doesn't have access to its environment, doesn't have access to its outside. Now, this is something I couldn't quite deal with. And while I love it, I love the claustrophobia of it. It makes perfect sense to me, despite the fact that we all agree, I think, that it's counterintuitive. Yet this idea that the system can only see within itself in order to see outside, it was the moment, was the autopoietic moment par excellence. And in a sense, this reconstruction of the external internally makes perfect sense. So it might be counterintuitive if you look at it in a kind of received wisdom about how everyday works, but it's not counterintuitive if you think about it psychoanalytically or in any other way, because indeed, how else do you see the world? Do you come into contact with the world except through a construction of what the world is for you? And even the hits you receive from the world, the unexpected bangs, these are still being somehow accommodated within your system of thought, and so you see now I'm moving and I do that very much. I move between the what Newman would call the social systems and the psychic system. So I move between the idea of the sociological system and the operations of a human mind. And I'm not opposed to that. In fact, this is what the original autopoiesis was doing with Maturana and Varela. And I think this was, this is a dangerous moment, but at the same time, a really, an absolutely vertiginously interesting moment. And I don't think that it's viable to keep on thinking about autopoiesis in the original way of systems theory. One should think of autopoiesis in precisely this post-human way. I mean, you know, Luhmann was very much post-human before the term was invented, in the sense that the kind of human that Luhmann was dealing with in his writings were always mediated by something else, whether it's technology, whether it's literature, whether it's religion, whether it's, you know, all that stuff. So that's exactly post-humanism. Post-humanism means essentially humanism has never been pure. It's always been mediated by something else, by a technological advance, by a tool, by language, by, you know, whatever it is. So I think it's really fascinating to think about that. And then to start thinking about Luhmann in elemental ways, that is, to start thinking about how, say, water will play into Luhmann. What happens when an element such as water starts, you know, working with a theory? And I've worked a little bit in terms of air with the theory of autopoiesis in my work on atmospheres. And that's exactly what I'm hoping to do now with water as well, because as opposed to air, which of course rots and rusts, but water soaks and dissolves. Mm-hmm. And I'm really interested in this dissolution. I still think that systems will always try and reconstruct the boundaries, whatever happens. But the dissolution that comes with the aquatic soaking is phenomenal. And I think it really is the moment of the planetary turning towards this kind of, you know, seriously, well, we can call it ecological, but I would say actually the moment of impending disaster and perhaps the moment of the end, and how we observe this turn of the planet towards a dissolution.
That's absolutely fascinating to me. I just quickly, your book on hydro justice, is it too soon to say when that will come out?
Well, it will come out in 2024, hopefully before the summer.
Okay, well, it sounds absolutely fascinating, and I'm happy that you're also bringing this to the ecological questions, because you're thinking through this autopoietic lens, but thinking about, as the word you use is these elemental kind of ideas, air, water, and I'm also moving in that direction myself, and that I'm trying to somehow marry systems theory with materiality, and I'm trying to link it these days with Marx's idea of the metabolic rift. And ooh, you know, it's not completely apparent to me how to do that yet. What do you think, speaking of ecology, I'm also clearly working on a lot of environmental law right now, and you've written on environmental law. What do you think current environmental law as it stands now, what are we getting wrong in environmental? Okay, this is a giant question. Yeah. I'm sorry, but
No, but I think it's quite an important question, and although the answer will not be important, but the question to ask the question is important, because quite a lot of people working within environmental law think that we get wrong is simply the fact that we don't have enough laws protecting the environment, or that
I like to describe it as that environmental lawyers keep telling us, okay, sing it again, but this time with more feeling.
Mm. Very good point. Yes, that's exactly it. And I think if one would play along this metaphor, I would say with less feeling, what we need to do now is actually think of the beyond the human. And environmental law is utterly failing to do that. I mean, it does a little bit, but tokenistically. And I've done some things on what I've vaguely called critical environmental law, and that's an attempt at post-humanizing, mineralizing the environmental law and thinking about a syntax of how for this, the new demands, let's say, of environmental law. And it's, okay, it might sound utopian, but I think it's, language is just one way of dealing with these issues. And quite a lot of environmental law must train itself in other methodologies and other ways of connecting. And when I said mineralizing, I was referring to Catherine Yusof's work on the inhuman, which is essentially the mineral. Catherine Yusof is, of course, a geologist. And while geology has never really played a very important part in environmental law, I think, especially after the Anthropocene, it's inexcusable to ignore geology. And it's not just about mining, etc. It's much, much more about the question of responsibility that the human has in relation to something much deeper than human life. So environmental law, if we were to play as I think I've done in the past, thinking about environment in Lumanian terms, it is actually looking into the thing that you cannot know, into the fundamentally unknown, the elemental indeed, that both includes you and surpasses you. And then trying to see how you can internalize it. And of course, the usual answer would be, okay, through language, through the operations of the law, through the usual, you know, in Lumen terms, the legal communication. Okay, so what is that? Is that enough? And I'm trying to understand the law now as material. And if we're talking about the materiality of the law, then we're talking about a law that doesn't exhaust itself in the language, or of course in the courts and in statutes, etc., but is dealing with practices that go certainly beyond the kind of Western understanding of the law. So the law can and does, in some respects, learn from indigenous practices, learns from tribal, you know, what sometimes Western law calls it customary law, but I don't think that describes anything. Mm-hmm. And looks into practices rather than statements. And so I think environmental law can do that because it's not, it still remains not a typical law. It can escape the conditions of its, let's say, origin, which, you know, is legal and textual, and can become a practice, a hands-on practice. Again, this has to do with thinking post-disciplinarily in terms of, so bringing together different kinds of disciplines and thinking about how the law, say, the practice of law and the practice of art are not dissimilar. Mm-hmm. They have very strong parallels. And quite often, while art often uses text, it's not exclusively or even majorly textual. And in that sense, I'm really interested in how to think of the law as art, not law as art, but law as using the practices of art and thinking of itself as non-textual. One thing that that we do at the University of Westminster, the Westminster Law School, which I am, is that we have at the end of the final year, we organize a degree show. So all final year students it's a compulsory module. They have to submit as a final project an artifact. Could be a painting, a performance, an installation, a cake, a poem, whatever. And we show these things under gallery conditions, and they're being assessed on that. And the theme of this is their responsibility as law students with regards to justice, the world, the changing world, why they're studying law, how they connect affectively to the law, and how this finds a materialization. So we're trying to make material law, to discover the law as matter in that degree show. And I know we are the only school in the world, pretty much, that we do that. And I must say, I'm inordinately proud of this because it's quite an endeavor, and it's absolutely wonderful. In fact, Stephen Bunbury and I, who lead the module, have written an article describing the processes, the vicissitudes, and the challenges of this endeavor. Mm. And I think it's published in the Law Teacher. But it is a meager attempt at opening up that space for students to think about law as matter. And that ultimately would be my goal, or my answer to what environmental law is getting wrong. It's that it remains immaterial.
Mm. Yes, thank you for that. I think we're out of time.
Well, yes, because considering the way that I answer questions, we're probably going to go on for another 10 minutes.
I mean, I can go on for the rest of the day, but I think your insights are really valuable and unique and important, and thank you for your time today.